We are with Tom Albright, who's the Professor and Director of the Vision Center Laboratory at the Salk Institute. Also, recently, due to the generosity of Conrad Priebus, an endowed chair in vision research, which would have been a nice thing to have happened to you. And we're actually in the Estancia La Jolla Hotel and Spa, which is just next door to the Salk. I want to get some sense of the field of vision research, but also the other things that you do, the contextual stuff that you're very interested in. Let me start with, actually, because I'm curious about this. This is Inside Salk, and there's a piece in here, a one-on-one with you. Since high school, Tom Albright has been fascinated by how we see, first sentence. I always ask people, how did they get into this business, and how and so on? Was it some sort of something in high school, a teacher, your parents, were your parents scientists? I mean, what does this sentence mean? You're interested in how we see.
A reasonable response to that is, how could you not be interested in how you see? Everybody sees. You open your eyes and everything's there. How does that happen? It's extraordinary. It's a very complicated problem. And yet we do it effortlessly and it rarely fails. So how I got interested in it, they put it in high school there. That wasn't exactly what I said, but that's not the point. The point is that it's a compelling problem. My father was an engineer, but he was really a polymath and a guy who was interested in all sorts of things, and he probably inspired me. He died when I was young, and so I sort of wandered a bit, kind of adrift, and ultimately decided that science was really the thing. And I had this fascination with human behavior, and vision seemed to me sort of an approachable aspect of human behavior. That is, if we could understand how it is that we recognize objects and interact with those objects, that would be an extraordinary development. And it turned out that at that time, there were a number of really sort of seminal developments in the field that I was in the right position to take advantage of, to learn new techniques, physiology in particular.
So you're talking about going, this is when you're going to the University of Maryland?
In Maryland, I had an interest in it before then, but at the University of Maryland, I major in psychology, which, people are normally dismissive of, but in fact I was quite interested in human behavior, and there were laboratories there looking at the brain bases of visual perception and visually guided behavior. And so I approached the people who were running those laboratories and I said, look, I'd like to get some experience doing this kind of thing. And I started working in a laboratory and I was completely taken in by the whole field and the advice that was given to me at the time by the guy who was a great mentor at a sort of critical point in my career. The guy's name was Bill Hodos. A comparative neurobiologist, and he actually studied the avian visual system, but he's a colleague of Harvey Karton, and did comparisons of how visual systems have evolved differently in animals with different behavioral goals. Mm-hmm. And that sort of set me off, and he gave me the very wise guidance to go into physiology, because that was the thing in those days. This was in the mid-70s, and Hubel and Wiesel were, they'd already spent 15 years doing their seminal studies, but it was becoming recognized as probably the most powerful technique in all of systems neuroscience at the time. And so I set about trying to get into graduate school to learn those techniques, and one person that I was advised to talk to was Charlie Gross. Hmm. And Charlie Gross came into the field a little bit behind Hubel and Wiesel, but he decided to, instead of going to the earliest stages of visual processing, he went to the sort of pinnacle of the visual processing stream, the inferior temporal cortex, and in the late 1960s had done these extraordinary but incredibly controversial studies demonstrating the existence of face cells in inferior temporal cortex. And he got a lot of recognition for that at the time, but over the 1970s, increasingly there were outcries of, how could that possibly be true? Face cells in the visual cortex, that's absurd. We want to go back to the Hubel and Wiesel reductionist approach. Look for cells that are responding to the basic elements of faces, not the faces themselves. And Charlie had sort of skipped all that and gone to the top. It turns out, as you're probably aware, there are many, many replications of those experiments that have occurred over the past three decades now. and it's very well documented. And it's extraordinary. If you actually see one of these face cells, it's really, it's one of the most extraordinary things I've seen as I've worked in the field of visual physiology. I mean, these cells are highly selective for a very specific type of stimulus.
But this is to jump ahead a little bit, but since you're on that topic, let's at least deal with that thing. If you're talking about Nancy Kamish's work on the fusiform face area and so on, you're talking about Christoph Koch and Itzhak Fried coming up with Jennifer Aniston cells. That's obviously controversial in the sense that how could there possibly be a cell which is so highly specified?
And
the notion of a modular brain versus, can you speak to those kind of topics?
Right. I mean, the same issue came up in the late 1960s, early 1970s, when Charlie Gross presented these face cells. Although Charlie, at the time, was not making the claim that these cells were selective for a particular face, but rather they were more generically selective for faces. Faces are obviously incredibly important for what people do. This is true, actually, for most mammals. We interact with others of our species by looking at their faces. We read a lot. There's emotional content. There's a lot of semantic content that's carried by the face, and that's how we recognize people and from the day we're born, essentially. So it's not surprising that there should be a neural system specific for faces. It is actually rather surprising that there should be individual neurons that are selective for particular faces. And it's probably not the case, we don't know this, but it's unlikely to be the case that there's only one neuron that's selective for Jennifer Aniston or whatever. It's probably a large collection of cells that are contributing to that particular percept, and the more salient that object is in one's sort of cognitive space, the larger the number of neurons that are representing that object.
So you did a doctorate in psychology and neuroscience at Princeton.
At Princeton, yes.
And then postdoctoral work at Princeton. Charlie was at Princeton, Charlie Gross?
Charlie Gross was at Princeton, that's right.
All right. So but these sort of classic papers now also from the 80s with Bob Desimone and Charlie Gross.
Yeah. This
is much later than Charlie's original work, isn't it?
This is a 1984, I don't have my glasses.
Stimulus selective properties of the IT neurons in the mechanics.
Right, so this was an effort on Charlie's part to, if you will, redeem his credibility, because a lot of people were very critical that he hadn't done, the original studies were done in the style of Hubel and Wiesel of the 60s, where it was a stimulus, it was projected up on a screen, and there was a sort of subjective evaluation of the response to that stimulus. And so Charlie's goal was to actually present these stimuli in a systematic way and quantify the neuronal response systematically.
Right.
To bring it to the level of the current standards of the field of visual neurophysiology. So that's what we did in that experiment. And we documented, or I should say we replicated, everything that Charlie originally described and provide documentation that really carried a lot of weight. And so this is actually probably one of the more commonly cited papers of that genre,
right,
simply because the earlier papers, people said, well, yeah, he waved a face in front of the monkey and he got a response, but big deal, how did he control for X, Y, and Z?
Right.
This was a study in which a lot of things were controlled for, and the whole thing was quantified more systematically.
Another paper at this time with you and Bob Desimone and Charlie is on the visual area MT of the mechanic, which now, and this becomes your area, really, doesn't it, MT?
That's right, yeah.
When I was Could you also, just for a general audience, say what IT and MT mean?
So IT stands for the inferior temporal cortex, and it is commonly referred to as the pinnacle of the ventral visual processing stream. The processing stream in visual cortex that's critical for object recognition. There are basically, the general notion is there are two streams of processing heading out of primary visual cortex, which is on the occipital pole on the backside of the brain. And one stream of processing extends up into the parietal lobe, and that's critical for visual spatial analyses, detection of motion and that kind of thing. And the ventral stream, which extends down in the temporal lobe, is critical for object recognition. And the data are largely consistent with that view. And the inferior temporal cortex, and that view wasn't really salient at the time when these experiments were done. It was Leslie Ungerleiter that proposed that concept in the late 70s, and this was around the same time. So we were recording in the inferior temporal cortex, which is the, again, the highest level of purely visual processing in the ventral cortical stream. And it had been known for, well, since the 60s, that these cells respond to very complex objects of a variety of types, but particularly faces. And so the notion was that they're these sort of biological feature detectors, things that they're designed to detect things that are of great biological significance to us as human observers, which of course faces are.
So, how does your trajectory go from there?
I mean, I got into that experiment as a graduate. So Bob Desmond was already in the laboratory.
Who's now running the?
He's the head of the McGovern Center at MIT.
Right.
Yeah. Charlie had a lot of good people in there. So Bob was the person I learned how to do physiology with. And Charlie was the head of the lab. And Charlie was a great source of inspiration, but he was not the person who was doing it.
Well, he was technically, I suppose, a psychologist, wasn't he?
That's right. He came from a psychology background, actually a neuropsychology background. Right. He was trained with Larry Weizkrantz and Hans-Lucas Teuber at MIT, but then got into physiology while still at MIT by collaborating with Peter Schiller and a variety of other people. In any case, Bob was the person I learned physiology with, and it was part of Bob's program, if you will, to do this experiment on IT cortex. In the lab at the time, this was during a period of time in which it was a sort of revolution afoot in the field of visual physiology. There was recognition that there weren't just two or three extra striate visual areas beyond primary visual cortex, but there were a whole bunch of them. It turns out that we now know there's something on the order of 36 in the rhesus monkey, probably a similar number in the human brain. And the general notion was these areas are specialized for a variety of different types of processing of visual information. So an area specialized for motion processing, area specialized for color processing, and so on. This idea had been advanced most forcefully initially by Simir Zeki. And Zeki had done some of the groundwork. In fact, Zeki was the first person who systematically recorded from area MT. And published this, I think, around 1970. And so there was the sort of general feeling at the time that I was in graduate school that we needed to do systematic studies of the response properties of these different areas and quantify precisely what their contributions were to this sort of multi-attribute analysis of the visual image. So we set out to study MT. It's probably the easiest of all the extrastriate areas to study for a whole variety of reasons. And there had been a suggestion, a hypothesis, that there's actually a columnar organization of directionally selective cells. And this was important because Mountcastle in the 1950s had advanced the notion that columnar organization was one of the sort of fundamental organizing principles of the cerebral cortex. And of course, Hebel and Beazle had done this in the striate cortex. So we looked at NMT. We did a systematic study. The basic idea was make a whole bunch of electrode penetrations and look at how preferred direction of motion varies along the penetration. And it did quite systematically. And so that was actually part of my thesis. And it turned out to be an incredibly powerful study in the sense that the whole line of research based on electrical microstimulation, was based on the premise that there is columnar organization in area MT. The microstimulation experiments of Newsom and Movshin and colleagues simply wouldn't work if there wasn't a columnar organization in area MT, because you're going to have to activate a bunch of cells that have the same preferred direction in order to get an effect. And I also at the time did a systematic study. This is sort of the way things, the way people did those things in those days was to record from cells and vary a stimulus along a single dimension and look at how the response varied. That was the sort of Hubel and Wiesel approach, and we did that in area MT, and I published this paper on the quantitative characteristics of direction and orientation selectivity in area MT. But it wasn't long after that that I realized that there was, if we're going to really understand these areas, it was something it was sort of a direction we had to go in that was very different from simply quantifying the response to a stimulus varying along a certain direction. We had to look at how the response varied in a way that's associated with perceptual state. And I had that insight when I was still in Charlie's lab as a postdoc, and the first experiment I did of that sort was to take a stimulus. Turns out there's a variety of different ways you can define a stimulus. We look around the world and the stimuli are typically defined by multiple, by contrast on multiple dimensions. In experiments of the sort that Hubel and Wiesel had done, luminous contrast was the dimension of choice. But you can create a stimulus, it's defined by texture, it's defined by dynamic texture, defined by color, defined by a whole variety of different attributes, and you can see those stimuli move. And so I asked a simple question, well, you know, if motion perception is based on the responses of these cells in area MT, then those cells ought to respond invariantly to the cue that defines the stimulus. It was a sort of, I called it form cue invariance, and it's a type of perceptual constancy. That is, the percept of motion should not depend upon this cue that defines the stimulus. And it turned out that was true. And this was, to my mind, the right approach to understanding the contribution of these areas to perception. So the question was no longer really about what does MT do, but how does cortex work? How does cortex respond, how does it give you perceptual invariance, for example? How does it extract one feature and generalize across a bunch of other features? And we went on to do a whole series of experiments along those lines. The goal of which was to assess how cortex works as opposed to simply understanding area MT.
Do you think you know how cortex works?
I think I know what one of the fundamental computations in sensory cortex is. And that was the motivation, or it was the conclusion drawn, and probably some of the motivation for the whole series of experiments that we did on the role of context in visual processing. Mm. So
I was going to say the context thing is something I wanted to get to. The piece that this is an HHMI article piece actually, where it talks about you having been studying the crucial importance of contextual clues to visual perception, and there's this notion of context, the brain's best guess. And I was talking to Chuck Stevens earlier about the whole, you know, issues of how the brain actually works, the unreliability of transmission, all those sorts of things, the fault tolerance and so on. And I think that people at home think that the brain is to some extent a bit like a computer, you know, there's just very clear transmission pathways and it hits a synapse and transmitters emerge and so on. And jump across gaps and all done very efficiently and so on, which of course it isn't. No. So could you speak to that whole notion?
Well, there's a big problem in vision, which is, it's formally referred to as the inverse problem of optics. That is to say, you have a world out there, there's light that's reflected off of things in the world, we know the world exists, and that light is then refracted by the crystalline lens in the eye and projected onto the back surface of the eye. You have an image on the back surface of your eye. And from that image, and this is, again, is the fundamental problem of vision, from that image, the brain tries to infer the causes of that image. And it's an ill-posed problem, it's a problem without a unique solution. There simply is not enough information in that image in the back of the eye for you to reliably reconstruct what's out there in the world. And yet we do it. We do it reliably most of the time. Every now and then we fail, we call those illusions. But I look around the world here and I don't suffer from ambiguity. I know what's out there. And the only way we can solve that problem computationally, the only way we can get around this inverse problem of optics, is by including additional sources of information. And one additional source of information is what we call the local context, which is the other stuff that happens to be in the image at the same time. So for example, if there were if there was a bicycle in front of me and the bicycle was partially occluded by some other object, I can very reliably infer where the bicycle extends beyond that object. I'm drawing conclusions about what's in my environment in the absence of direct information, based on inferences from other sources of information. So that's local context, and there's a whole variety of those kinds of experiments that we've done in my laboratory to try and get at the neural basis of those, which I can tell you about. Another source of context, of course, a major other source of context, is your prior experiences with the world. As you go around the world, you learn certain things about it, and you use that information, your priors about the world, in order to develop hypotheses about what's out there at any point in time. You have to remember, the image coming in, not only is it not enough information, but it's often noisy, it's ambiguous, it's incomplete, and we fill in the blanks. We fill in the blanks based on what's most likely to be there based on our prior experiences with the world.
And the fact that the brain is making its best guess at that point is precisely how people can construct visual illusions, because they know where the gaps are.
Yeah, this is how magicians work. They force you to guess the wrong thing, and your brain does it. I mean, it's very reliable, very predictable. Yeah. And we can identify the neural correlates of those influences on the processing of sensory information.
And personal variation. You made the point. Very nice point in here. Quoting you, an artist like Turner, the English pre-impressionist painter, may have a radically different view of the world, and the whole notion of the connection between the visual arts and science, of course.
Well, this is an old idea. Gombrich, great 20th century art historian, developed this idea and called it the beholder's share. So when you look at a painting, for example, you bring something to the table. It's not simply the sensory qualities of the image that are entering through your retina and going up to your visual cortex. It's your prior experiences with the world. The whole field of impressionism, and in fact, most of post-realistic painting, painting subsequent to roughly the mid-19th century, painting that deviated from an effort to try and depict the world with very high fidelity, was based on the idea that if you provide just an impression, that impression is a spark that would trigger memory and cause you to layer onto the image all your prior experiences with the world and see it uniquely in a way that's unique to you. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you about the neural basis of those effects, because we've now begun to study how memory influences the signals in visual cortex.
Well, why don't you just elaborate on that a little bit?
So the standard approach, this was the Hubel-Wiesel approach, and the approach through most of the late 20th century and early 21st century visual physiology, is to look at how the responses in visual cortex, responses of individual neurons, are related to properties of the retinal stimulus. But we know perfectly well that the things that you see are not defined solely by what's on your retina. They're defined in many cases by what you know to be true. This is the point I was making earlier. And so we did a very simple experiment, sort of violating the traditions in the field, in which we trained an animal to associate two stimuli. So the animal learns that stimulus A is associated with stimulus B, and he sees them, and stimulus C is associated with stimulus D. He sees these over and over and over again, and so it's a real easy association for him after he's done it 100,000 times. I show him A, and he chooses B. I show him B, he chooses A. I show him C, he chooses D, and so on. After we've done that, and it turns out in the experiment we did, those stimuli happen to be an arrow in the one case and a direction of motion in the other. So the animal learns that an upward pointing arrow, which is stationary, is paired with some dots that are moving upwards. A downward pointing arrow, which is stationary, is paired with some dots that are moving downward. So after he knows this completely. And I should say, we had done a previous series of experiments, which I had skipped over, in which we looked at the neural basis of that learning. So what I'm going to tell you now is what the learning causes in visual cortex. So we then record from cells in area MT. And of course, these cells are highly directionally selective. And we present the motion stimuli, and we get very nice motion tuning curves to those cells, just as you would expect, nothing surprising there. But then we present the arrows. And this sort of knocked us out of our chairs, because we find that these cells, not only do they respond to the arrows, but they're highly selective for the direction the arrow is pointing. There's nothing at all moving in the receptive field. And so what's going on? You know, I tell this to a few of my sort of traditional visual physiology friends, and they say, well, you must have, through this experience, you've sort of co-opted cells in area MT for the purpose of representing the arrows, which I can't actually rule that out, but it seems unlikely that you could that easily sort of deconstruct this nice systematic system for representing the motion of stimuli in the world. The alternative is that the cell is representing motion, but it's not representing motion on the retina. There is none. It's representing the motion that's recalled by association. Mm-hmm. I present that arrow, and in the monkey's mind's eye, he's thinking of the motion because that's what's always there. And those cells that are active in area MT are basically the neural correlate, the cause, if you will, of that visual imagery of motion. And that's the argument we make, is that basically the system is set up so that visual stimuli, or any kind of sensory stimuli, through associations in memory, can activate early sensory cortical areas. And you might well ask, well, what's the point of that? Why do we need to activate these early sensory areas? Mm-hmm. And the answer is, going back to a point I made earlier, that the visual input is noisy, it's incomplete, it's ambiguous. And so most of the time, you need prior associations, you need to fill in the blanks in order to know what's out there.
And the arrow is being represented where?
That's a good question. So the arrow has to be represented someplace, because you perceive the arrow. Yeah. It's not represented in area MT. You can find cells that respond to it in primary visual cortex. I presume you could find cells that would respond to it in area V4, and certainly also inferior temporal cortex. Right. And based on these other experiments that I alluded to, we know that inferior temporal cortex is one of the sites of associative learning. That is, the engram is actually there. There's a change in synaptic weights in the inferior temporal cortex that supports the association between stimulus A and stimulus B, the arrow and the motion in this case. And when I see an arrow, our presumption is that signal is going up through the system. It's activating these cells, these memory cells in the inferior temporal cortex, activating whatever has been associated with the arrow stimulus. And then there's a sort of chain of activity going back down into visual cortex to activate the features of objects that have been associated with the arrow.
Were those experiments actually done, though, to locate the where the arrow is represented?
No, not in these experiments, but there are many experiments in which people have recorded from cells in the inferior temporal cortex, and I'm sure somebody has presented an arrow stimulus to those neurons. We didn't do that experiment.
So, several references have been going through here as we've been going through this. I mean, it's not surprising at all. You're also a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, aren't you, as well?
Yes.
And a lot of, when we talk on campus and so on, there's a lot of visual arts stuff comes up as well. We just mentioned painting already right there. You mentioned Samir Zeki. I mean, he was one of the founders of what would be called neuroaesthetics, I suppose.
Yes.
Ramachandran deals a lot with these sort of things. So it's not surprising that people who work in vision and neuroscience are also interested in seeing how that maps onto the visual arts. Mm. Talk about a bit about that.
It's a natural question. Why do people produce? This is a complicated answer to this question, but the question is, why do people produce art? And what is it that they're representing? And, you know, Gombrich's point was that for most of the history of art in Western society, it was about illusion. It was about trying to sort of create...
Illusion.
It was about creating something that looks like what you know the real world to be with ever and ever greater fidelity. So you basically, on canvas, created something that is such a great illusion that you don't recognize it as something on canvas. You actually think it's the real world. I mean, that was the ultimate goal. Now, it turns out, that, you know, as I said before, art changed a lot in the last 200 years, and one of the major goals and driving forces in art now is this effort to try and stimulate the brain to bring something to the table, the so-called beholder's share. Mm-hmm. So, but in any case, it's natural to wonder, well, how do we get experiences from art? And I think I mentioned this already, but the kind of experience that you get, and this doesn't count for all of your experiences, but some of the experiences you get from Impressionist painting come from memory being layered upon the signals coming back up from the retina. So you have this combination of things. And there are many, many, you know, art is just one example of that. There are many, many domains in which you get sort of the fusion of signals from the retina and signals coming back from memory store. Magic, I mentioned this before, magic is an example of that. I took an interest recently in the problem of forensic fingerprint analysis, because it's an example of a similar sort of thing. You know, the classic failure of forensic fingerprint analysis was the Madrid train bombing in 2004. You know the story. So the FBI and the Spanish National Police, it was, you know, a devastating attack on these commuter trains coming into the Central Railway Station in Madrid. And they identified a van at the scene of the crime. And in the van were these bomb detonator caps, and it turns out the plastic bags, and they were covered with fingerprints. This was the failure of the perpetrators. And so the FBI, this is what they do best, they extract fingerprints, and they put them into this big database, or computer pattern matching system that has a database associated with it of something on the order of several hundred million, fingerprints from several hundred million people. And what the computer typically does is it'll find the 20 most likely matches for that forensic fingerprint. And so in this case, it spit out 20 matches, but ultimately this is a visual pattern matching problem. People make the ultimate decision about whether the forensic fingerprint came from the same person as the fingerprint that's in the database. And they had three people in the case of the Madrid bombing, three expert fingerprint examiners who came to the same conclusion about the origin of the print found at the crime scene. And it turned out that print was from a man named Brandon Mayfield, who was he was 37 years old at the time. He was a practicing family lawyer in Portland, Oregon. And it turns out that the guy he was a Muslim convert. And he was married to an Egyptian-born U.S. citizen. And at some point in his career as a family practice lawyer, he did mostly child custody things. He defended a guy named Jeffrey Battle, who was a member of the Portland Seven, which is was a terrorist cell in Portland with ties to Al-Qaeda. Huh. And so there were various pieces of circumstantial evidence that supported what the FBI had concluded. And based on the authority of the USA Patriot Act, they watched this guy 24 hours a day at home and at work. And after a few weeks of doing that, they said, well, you know, we've got our guy, let's nail him. And they arrested him. They arrested him under the provisions of the material witness statute, which is it's a feature of US law that says that if you have somebody who has information that's material to the solution of a crime, who you would normally hold by subpoena, you can actually put them in jail. You can lock them up without actually charging them with a crime. There's a terrible abuse of this provision. Anyway, that's the way they locked him up. And they put him in jail for 2 weeks. And then the Spanish National Police came along and said, well, wait a second. We've got the guy. And there's lots of other circumstantial evidence that support this conclusion. And he's an Algerian man who does actually have ties to Al-Qaeda. And who's this guy you've got in jail? And so the FBI looked at the case a little bit more closely and then realized they'd made a mistake and they let him go. But it boils down to it's a visual pattern matching problem that failed catastrophically. And it failed for three people. Why did three people say that this exemplar from the database came from the same person as the one found at the crime scene? What was going on in their visual systems?
Yeah, wouldn't you have thought a computer could do that better, though?
Computers can do this very reliably for high-quality fingerprints. That's how it's usually done. So Homeland Security, to identify people that are already registered in the database. The problem with forensic fingerprints is they're typically...
low quality.
They're low quality, they're noisy, they're smear, they're occlusions. This is why it's a very difficult visual pattern matching problem. And a computer can say, you know, these are... the set is possible, but it can't tell for certain, and U.S. law requires a person to make that decision. And people are fallible, and they're fallible for two reasons, one of which is kind of trivial. It's a signal detection problem. It's simply impossible, given the overlap, given the various sources of noise associated with production of a fingerprint, and given the overlap in ways that fingerprints from two people might be produced, you can only say with a certain probability that this fingerprint came from person A as opposed to from people who are not person A. You can say, well, there's a 60 or 70% probability. The trouble in America, of course, is that in a court of law, you have to be 100% certain. This is required by the statutes of law. You can't go into court and say, well, you know, I think with 60% reliability that it's person A. You just can't do that because you can only be, in a court of law, you're either guilty or you're not guilty. You can never be 60% guilty. It doesn't make any sense. So that's one problem. It's a signal detection problem. But the more interesting problem for me, and this is where all this goes back to, is what I call the implicit visual imagery problem. And the FBI actually, you know, did a whole lot of soul searching and hand-wringing after this. It was a huge embarrassment for the FBI. And they published a report, and in that report they acknowledge that as the people were making the comparisons, and they believed it was from this guy, as they were making the comparisons, they began to fill in the blanks, which is effectively saying that they're in their mind's eye, they're creating images that correspond to the exemplar and filling in the blanks on this noisy image, much in the way that, you know, if you're watching a magic show and the magician is trying to get you to fill in the blanks a certain way, you do fill in the blanks that particular way. Only in this case, the consequence, you know, it's not just a magic trick, it's profound consequences for this man's life. And for, you know, criminal justice in American society, you can imagine that it's been estimated that there are many, many, probably tens of thousands of people who've been inappropriately incarcerated based on fingerprint evidence. And this is just one case that happened to reach a threshold to get into the popular press. But a good part of it is one of the failures of, well, failure is the wrong word, but one of the features of visual processing is that we try to make something out of noisy signals. We try to see pattern in them. And a small bit of suggestion will cause you to see a particular pattern.
Yeah. These things that come off the edge of the vision story. Somebody, I think it was Teresinowski, was telling me that you're also very interested now in schizophrenia and vision.
Oh, you're right. So we've... So one of the theories, modern theories of schizophrenia, for a long time, the understanding of the neuropathology associated with schizophrenia was dominated by the so-called dopamine theory of schizophrenia. And dopamine plays an important role, there's no question about it, and many of the effective antipsychotic medications modulate dopamine levels, and there's no question that dopamine's critical for some of the symptoms of schizophrenia. But a more recent theory of schizophrenia is what's called the glutamate theory, which is that there are pathologies associated with glutamate neurotransmission in the cerebral cortex such that the circuitry, the, in effect, in simple terms, the balance of excitation and inhibition in the cerebral cortex is dysfunctional. Mm-hmm. So normally you have circuits that are made of, you know, as a complex network of excitatory and inhibitory neurons in the cerebral cortex. And if you take, for example, the inhibitory interneurons out of commission, then you have hyperexcitation, the circuits don't work properly, they don't compute what they're supposed to compute. And the theory is that this underlies many of the, what are typically called the cognitive symptoms of schizophrenia, which include problems with attention, problems with sensory processing. And well, the beauty of that for us is this is exactly what we do. We study neural circuits in the cortex and how they underlie attention and sensory processing and perception. So this sort of gave us an entry point into the field because we're experts in understanding circuitry, although in this case it's pathological circuitry. So then the question became, is there a way we can create an animal model of schizophrenia? And there is a pharmacological method which we've been testing out in my lab, which involves using ketamine. Ketamine is it's a
vitamin K, as yeah. John Lilly used to call it.
Yeah, no, it's an abuse drug, but it's also a very widely used veterinary and pediatric anesthetic. And PCP, or phencyclidine, which also used to be used as an anesthetic. These are in the category of what are called dissociative anesthetics. That's why they're interesting for recreational use. And they've been used. What these drugs do is they block glutamate receptors, but in particular they block NMDA receptors.
Right.
And so this is a way of pharmacologically messing up the system, messing up cortical circuitry in a way that we believe mirrors what's happening in schizophrenia. It turns out that low levels, and I'm talking about, we call these subanesthetic doses, they're about a tenth of the dose that you would normally use for anesthesia. It turns out that they create a set of symptoms. There's both an acute phase and a chronic phase, but if you have a single dose within a period of an hour or so after the dose, a person or an animal will be in a state which is in many ways akin to some of the sensory and attentional problems associated with schizophrenia. So the behavioral outcome is similar. And what we've been looking at is neurophysiological measures which mirror those seen in schizophrenia. Hmm. And it turns out there's something, I mean, it's kind of obscure, but there's something known as an evoked potential that can be recorded using scalp electrodes. It's known as the mismatch negativity. It's a difference in the response between a repeated stimulus versus a stimulus that's novel. It exists, or the interpretation is, that this mismatch negativity exists as a form of sensory memory. So as the stimulus is repeated over and over and again, there's a gradual tonic inhibition of that stimulus. There's no useful information mm-hmm. associated with that stimulus. But a new stimulus comes on, and bang, you get a big response again because it provides information. Hmm. Now in schizophrenics, that's gone. You repeat a stimulus over and over again, you throw in a new stimulus, and the response to the new stimulus is the same as the response to every other stimulus. So that form of sensory memory, that tonic inhibition of a stimulus that repeats, is not there in schizophrenics. Turns out, you give ketamine in a very low dose, and it's not there in animals with ketamine. So physiologically and behaviorally, using behavioral measures of sensation and perception, the effect of the ketamine is virtually identical to what's seen in schizophrenia. And so the plan is, we're really just at this point at the stage of validating this as an animal model, and the plan is to go on and try to explore physiological changes, the changes in the local circuitry in the cortex that underlie these behavioral or perceptual changes. Now, the problem with ketamine, of course, though, is that it's given systemically, and so it's probably affecting lots of different brain systems.
Yeah.
And so what you'd really like is a local schizophrenia, a focal schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. If I could mess up the cortex in the prescribed way, in a very localized region of the cerebral cortex, I ought to get circuit changes that are consistent with those seen in schizophrenics, and I ought to get perceptual and physiological alterations of the circuit that are consistent with those that are seen in schizophrenia. And so how do you do this? Optogenetics. Because optogenetics will enable us to turn off particular classes of cells in the same way that ketamine would turn them off by blocking glutamate receptors. And we can do this very locally in the cortex and create a local or focal schizophrenia in an experimental animal. So I think that's where the future is headed. But in the meantime, we're using this pharmacological approach while we develop the optogenetics. Mm.
So one question I ask people is there anything else that they could possibly imagine themselves doing in their lives? I mean, I notice in this piece, I mean, this is this beautiful table here, which you built. You're obviously very good with your hands. And there's also a picture here of, John, I don't know whether you're actually seeing this or not, this watercolor. So you obviously paint as well.
Yeah.
I mean, are you a frustrated carpenter or?
I've always liked to work with my hands. In fact, that's one of the reasons I got into science is I could work with my hands. Of course, I don't work with my hands anymore, except for typing. But yes, I like to build things. I have a sort of keen visual sense and a sense of visual aesthetics. That's partly why I'm interested in this architecture.
I was going to get to that. Yeah. So before I get to that, though, just one quick thing. I always ask people this who've you know, successful careers and so on. What's your advice to a young scientist, somebody coming in at this point? Anything? Because you mentioned a good mentor.
A good mentors are important. These are tough days in science, and a lot of people get discouraged because it doesn't look like there's much of any future. But I think the important message is there will always be room for the best. And so the critical thing is to be the best. And how do you get to be the best? You know, I never thought of myself as, I was smart enough, but I think a lot of it just boiled down to hard work. As a graduate student, I never gave up. I just kept plugging away. And I did have good mentors, and that's an important thing. And, you know, I've heard a lot of people have sort of disasters in graduate school where they didn't get along with their thesis advisor and the whole thing was a mess and they got depressed and sort of wandered off. And that's unfortunate, and I don't really know how to navigate those shoals, but it is critical that you get somebody who is sort of sympathetic to what you can bring to the table. But it's also critical to just really work hard, because it's the only way to get to the top. You know, it's one thing to be smart, and this was the point of Gladstone's book. Malcolm Gladwell.
Yeah. Okay.
What is the title of the book? I'm blanking on it. Anyway, the point is that it's one thing to be smart, but you also have to be in the right place at the right time and recognize that you're in the right place at the right time. And I see a lot of students who come into the field and they take a lot of things for granted. They don't see that what the opportunities are for them. They're smart, but they don't really recognize what could happen if they did this. Mm-hmm. And so that's a sort of critical part of all this, is knowing what the possibilities are, realizing what the possibilities are and how you can sort of bring them to their full potential, given who you are and where you are. You know, a lot of people want to go to graduate school, they want to go and study with a particular person because that person has a name and in the field. And that's not always what it's about. It's about you bringing something in the right place at the right time and recognizing that it's the right place in the right time.
You mentioned we have on the Science Network, as you know, we've covered a number of presentations of the Academy of Neuroscience for Architecture. You did one recently. I just called this up on my iPhone because I wanted to get the title right. Yours was called Vastuveda in the Age of Neuroscience: Some Brain-Based Principles for the Design of Human Environments. To me, that means the this use of Vedic architecture and so on. So, do you want to gloss this a little bit?
The principle of Vastu was that this is an ancient Hindu tradition. The Vedas were, of course, ancient Hindu texts that were designed, they were written about all varieties of life in ancient Hindu societies. And this one was about architecture. And the notion was that the architecture you're in, the place that you live, the place where you work, ought to, in multiple ways, sort of reinforce your mental state and lead to optimal mental states. That, you know, this seemed like in those days it was it seemed fairly obvious to the people who built architecture. You look around today, you go down the street, and there's no thought of this at all. Most of American architecture today is abysmal. There's no a sense of the consequences of living in a certain environment on one's mental state. And I think the goal of ANFA, the Academy of Neuroscience for Architecture, is the same as the goal of the Vastu from thousands of years ago, which is to design things in a way that in some way enhance our mental state. The difference now, of course, is we have the field of neuroscience. And so we have quantitative measures of brain states. And we can look at how those measures relate to properties of architecture that we know works versus properties of architecture that doesn't work. And we can try and identify whether there's some organizational principles in the brain that cause a particular building to facilitate learning, to facilitate mental health.
My memory is, though, that there are some of the parts of that involve things like in which direction the building is facing, and which is more healthy, and whether it's a south-facing building or a north-facing building.
That was some of it. That's right. There's also a particular layout of the building. And I'm not arguing that the principles of the Academy of Neuroscience, the principles that the Academy are working towards, are the same as the principles used in Vastu. The point is, the goal is the same. This is a long-standing goal of architecture. Architecture has always bowed to biology, basically. We build things to conform to people, because people use these architectural environments. The new thing is, because we now know about neurobiology, we can, in principle, build things to conform to what we know about the brain. If the brain, if I know enough about the visual system to say that, well, you know, your brain's going to respond in a particular way, which is optimal, and this is a big question, how do you define optimal? It's going to be, signal processing is going to be optimal with this set of conditions, then that's a good reason why you might want to build that kind of building. Now, good architects already know what these principles are. The trouble is that there are not that many good architects, and most architecture, as I said earlier, in this country is just total crap. I mean, you can see this particularly in Southern California. I mean, it's just sort of mass-produced, and it's not inspiring at all. And yet people live in these places, and God knows what kind of consequences it's having on your levels of stress hormones and so forth. But these things are all measurable now, and again, I stress, in principle, we ought to be able to know what the relationship is between how a brain senses a particular set of stimuli and how those stimuli elicit emotional responses, how they elicit stress responses, how information is stored in memory, and all of that information, in principle, could be used to guide architecture. Yeah.
I'd like to do another conversation with you about architecture, specifically, I mean, one of the reasons that this whole notion of the two cultures, the arts and the sciences, Jacob Bronowski, deputy director of the Salk when it first started, one of the founding fellows, he wrote a paper, Architecture as a Science and Architecture as an Art, back in 1955, which Snow knew about when he wrote about the two cultures and so on. So there's a whole conversation we could have about that, but let me ask you two or three of the standard questions that I like to ask people, and just to round off. One of them is this notion of you talk about lots of historical references here as well. If I gave you a time travel token to bring somebody to this wonderful table that you built here to have dinner from any period of history, any discipline. Is there anybody you'd really like to sit down with and have a conversation with and ask some questions of?
Well, there's just too many to...
It's a big table.
Well, it's a big table, yeah. I mean, the problem with that kind of question is, and I don't want to critique your interview, but the problem with that kind of question is that it forces one to narrow down the possibilities, and I don't want to narrow down the possibilities.
That's right.
And there's a large number of people that, of course, I would find interesting to discuss both art and science with. Musicians of the 19th century, artists of the 19th century, and there's a lot of radical transformations in both music and art in the 19th century, and those are things that I think about a lot, and how the brain, how our understanding of neuroscience is relevant to that.
Yeah.
And so it would be interesting to talk to those people.
I ask that question because sometimes it just triggers an immediate response to something.
Yeah. So here's one. I'm trained in experimental psychology, and I find myself constantly going back and referencing William James.
Yeah.
William James was an extraordinary individual, and the breadth of things that he thought about, the depth of his thinking about certain things. I mean, he was wrong about a lot of stuff, but he was inspired. I mean, the guy was just a genius. And many of our current ideas about how perception and memory work, you can go back and read William James. Most people don't do this, but if you do, you can find them there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of these ideas that I discussed with you earlier about the nature of associative memory and how memory complements signals coming up from the retina, William James was on to all this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he couldn't record from neurons, but he knew of their existence and he developed hypotheses. So in that sense, these aren't even new ideas. The thing I bring to the table is the data. But James has been a great source of inspiration to me over the years and a source of ideas. And yes, it would be fascinating to sit down with William James.
Yeah, I agree with you. When he came into office, Obama said administration will restore science to its rightful place.
Yeah, he said he was going to make the budget for science 3% of the GDP.
What is the rightful place of science in society?
Science should be a guide for society. And unfortunately, in American society, it hasn't been, never has been, really. There was probably a period after the Second World War where it had a...
Vannevar Bush and so on. There was a lot of... Beginning of the National Science Foundation.
That's right. And major funding or organization of major funding through the National Institutes of Health. It's a funny society. You know, a lot of this, I think, has to do with the strong religious beliefs in America and the sort of dogmatic extreme that people take those religious beliefs to the point where science is, you know, these are just a bunch of people with some theories and you know, we'll let them have fun. But it doesn't guide what we do. You know, the most salient example of this, of course, is climate change. We're not doing anything. The data are there. We're not doing anything. And there are many examples. I mean, so childhood education is a good example. There's a ton of data from the field of cognitive psychology on childhood education. There's data from ANFA is interested, the Academy of Neuroscience for Architecture is interested in this from the point of view of how do you build an optimal classroom for kids. And there are data that would lead you in certain directions, but the people who spend the money on the classrooms, they don't listen to the data. It's as though the science is not important enough to act upon. We don't give it the kind of respect in this country that is given in other countries, for example. We don't revere scientists in this country. Funding of it, particularly funding of biomedical research, has long been strong because it's well documented that it's led to clinical treatments, and people want to live longer, they want to be healthy, and so they're willing to fund biomedical research. But if you want to know about quarks and neutrinos, most people say, what are you talking about? Why do we need to know that? Why are we building these
Large Hadron Collider.
Yeah, these particle accelerators. you know, they cost an enormous amount of money, but why is it important? And we don't know why it's important yet.
That's why it's called research.
That's why it's called research. And but the premise is that someday, you know, they have a great story about William Harvey, the man who discovered
circulation.
Yeah, right. He was the physician to the King of England. I think this was in the late 16th century, and he spent 20 years dissecting frogs. He was in his spare time. You know, mostly he was the physician of the King of England. He dissected these frogs in order to figure out how the heart worked and how the circulatory system worked. He didn't have any agenda. He wasn't trying to cure heart disease. He didn't know anything about heart disease. He just wanted to figure out how the thing worked. And it's now the basis of virtually all modern medicine, an understanding of circulation and how the heart works, how it pumps blood through the body, how it gets back and gets oxygenated. And it was basic research in its purest form. And we need more of that, of course. And Congress today tries to say, we're funding all this stuff, but we ought to be funding stuff that's going to cure cancer or it's going to cure Alzheimer's disease. And of course, there are many, many things that are important to understand that have nothing to do with those particular diseases, but will ultimately give us a body of information from which we can understand everything.
Mm-hmm. Last question for this session, anyway. What are you optimistic about?
Well, it depends on whether we're talking about science or society at large, although they're related. In science, I'm greatly optimistic by the development of lots of tools. There's long been this divide between the molecular biologists and the so-called systems biologists, of which I am one. And that gulf is being bridged now. There are a whole lot of techniques for molecular biology which we can now use. I mentioned one of them already. Optogenetics,
right.
Which we can now use to study large brain systems with precision and detail that we've never before had. And I think this has tremendous potential for enabling us to understand the underlying mechanisms of information processing in the brain by turning on and off different parts of the circuit and seeing what the consequences of that are for circuit function, measured physiologically, measured behaviorally, measured perceptually. So those are great reasons to be optimistic in the field of neuroscience today. Although, you know, I'd say I'm optimistic, but then the question is, well, where does the money come from? And of course, we live in a society today in which there is ever decreasing public funding for science, even for good science. And so we look to other sources. There are a lot of very wealthy people in this country, and a general philosophy, of course, about wealth in America is that America provided basically the infrastructure for people to become wealthy. Mm-hmm. And there are people who recognize that. The Jacobs family, of course, is one of the most salient examples. But I'm optimistic that there are many people of that type who have made an enormous amount of money, who recognize that it's now time for them to step up to the plate and fund science. Because without that, with current levels of public funding, we won't be able to really move forward.
Well, as I said, you now have the Conrad Priebus Endowed Chair in Vision Research, right. $2 million from Conrad, matching gift from Joan and Owen Jacobs.
That's right. Yeah, Conrad is a sort of ideal example of that kind of person, somebody who made a lot of money through a lot of hard work and dedication, but also because society provided him with the kind of infrastructure he needed in order to do well in business. And he feels, as many people do, that it's sort of incumbent upon him to give back to society, to support that society, that larger society. And this will happen. People will do this. I'm optimistic about the future of science in other countries. The United States has always led the way, right, at least for most of the 20th century. I have a lot of international collaborations, particularly in India. And India is, the country is changing so rapidly, and so much of the direction in which it's headed is guided by science. Sort of an interesting counterpoint to American culture. It's also a very religious culture, very spiritual, but science is part of that culture. There's no sort of rejection of science as being the antithesis of the religion in India. It's embraced by the religion. It's just a, you know, another source of information about the world. And so they're very big on funding science in India. And I think this will, there's a lot of brilliant people there, and they'll probably at some point in the next few decades play a major role in the advancement of many areas of science, neuroscience among them.
Tom Albright, thanks very much. Great to talk to you.
Pleasure.